Hi, and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. And for those of you that might be noticing that this is a video version of this show, it's usually going to be an audio podcast, but when we're at conferences and we are at the podcast studio, we'll actually have some video to go along with it, so you can actually see what we look like, and it may drive you back to the audio version, I don't know. But I do want to welcome you. I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and of course one of the hosts here of the Disaster Podcast. And we want to thank, as always, EMS Today for bringing us into the podcast studio here and having us, giving us a venue to do this show, as well as Physio Control for sponsoring the studio here at the podcast studio. And of course, the Disaster Podcast wouldn't be the Disaster Podcast without our friends at Paragon Medical Education Group, and we'll talk a little bit more about them later on in this episode. But I want to introduce my co-host, I guess you could call her, the person who has all the experience and expertise that I don't have with disaster medicine, and that's Sam Bradley.
There's actually something I know that you don't, Jamie.
There's a whole lot I don't know. I'm the first to admit that, and if you want to have a list, my wife can make that for you.
Well, I'm real happy to be here, and I'm glad my partners are here. This is going to be exciting because we realized in discussions at different conferences that this is an area of EMS, and it's way bigger than EMS, that really is not touched on as much. And being as that's what we do, we really want to bring this subject out to you folks and let you learn a little bit more about it. I have to show you. I hope I can
see. Go to the wide shot, Chris.
This is we went through a lot of pains to pick our logo. And we're pretty impressed with it.
It's nice.
We're happy with it.
Yeah.
It
looks great.
So we have to at least show it to you.
Thank you, Vanna.
That's as much as we have right now. But So, well, what do I do? I'll start with me. I've been a paramedic for 35 years, currently still working in the fire department environment, and thanks to my chief at Livermore Pleasanton Fire for letting me be here. And I've been a disaster junkie most of my life, starting with Red Cross work for a long time ago, and done a little MRC and done some things, and we'll talk about those. But mostly I'm a training officer for a federal disaster medical assistance team, and we'll talk more about those teams in a bit. So it's a different one than what these guys do. So Jim Logan, tell us about you and what you do.
Well, I'm Jim Logan. I'm an officer with the Memphis Fire Department. I've got 29 years of experience in EMS and the fire service. Since 1996, I've been involved with the FEMA Urban Search and Rescue Program, specifically Tennessee Task Force 1, as their one of their best medical specialists and rescue specialists, and I've also done the medical coordination for that team since then. So that's a little bit about me.
A little bit.
Yeah,
we're going to be learning a lot more about you guys as we go along. Dr. Joe Hawley.
I'm Joe Hawley. I'm the EMS Medical Director for Tennessee Task Force 1. Like Jim, I've been in EMS a very long time. I do medical direction for an awful lot of different EMS services in the area. And I've been involved in the federal urban search and rescue system pretty much since inception, like Jim. I think between us, we probably have 50 or so deployments in that system. So we've been very involved for a very long time.
And as if you didn't have enough to do, you and Jim came together and you're looking at the importance of training and the understanding that paramedics and others really like the hands-on type training. Tell us about Paragon.
Well, be glad to. And you're right. Based on the experiences we've had in disaster medicine and the concept that much of the stuff that happens there is for the vast majority of people in medical care of any sort, a once-in-a-career kind of experience. We've been lucky enough to do it a lot and sort of learn those lessons. And part of what we've tried to do is capture those lessons, not only from a hands-on procedural standpoint, but from how things work, operations, concepts, and how to take care of yourself, your team, and your patient, and put those things together in most of our training programs. So we're big believers in high fidelity simulation, realism. I think Jim's word is stress immersion, which I think is a great idea.
I don't know if that's my word, but that's the one
that's
I use. Yeah.
So, you know, it's all about getting folks through that first disaster experience where you tend to get the wide-eyed, slack-jawed stare and don't tend to get much accomplished, and how to deal with that, move on through that, and what you really can do in those circumstances that makes a difference to victims of the disaster that you're involved in.
And you guys have made a big splash here at EMS Today with your cadaver lab and the hands-on things that people are getting to do there. I know you all have heard some great feedback. Sam heard some amazing feedback. Even heard people talking about it around the floor. Some good buzz about it, but not just from it's great for Paragon, obviously, but it's great for those providers that got to get their hands on cadavers and really do something and work through procedures that they may have never really done on anything but a mannequin before.
Yeah, that's good stuff to hear. And that's kind of, it's you know, we're giving back to our profession really by offering those types of experiences, lesson learned, things like that. So what Joe's saying, you know, we don't do any death by PowerPoint.
Thank you.
You know, and that's how, you know, when we usually go for continuing ed classes, it's, you know, why am I here? We do a little bit of PowerPoint and then we dive right into, you know, the newest and coolest tools of the trade. And then we can back up and we can actually really hone in on those basic skills. And, you know, one of those things is really simple, and I'll let Joe address it because, you know, again, he had that station yesterday with the gross anatomy of just using a bag valve mask properly.
Really? Yeah.
Sure. And Jim's right. That's sort of a passionate thing for me, is that those basic skills that often get relegated to low man on the totem pole on the team are, in many cases, one of the most important things that we do. And I think it's an opportunity to really appreciate that we've got to stay sharp on our basic skills. It's not all always about advanced skills. Mm-hmm. Not that those aren't valuable as well, but that's part of it. And understanding the physiology behind what you're doing and why we do what we do. I'm a big believer in, I just don't want you to know how to do something. I want you to know why you do it. And that then allows you to know when is the right time for me to do it and what's the right patient I should do that on, and all those other things that come into play. And, you know, from a disaster medicine slant on all that sort of stuff, it's also that opportunity to think on your feet and innovate and you know, require you to use your brain. I can't just follow the protocol anymore.
And there's a falsehood, I think. You know, a lot of people think disaster medicine, they think that mass casualty triage mode where we don't manage airway, you know, aggressively. But if that's not the case in disaster medicine, because you're really looking at just longer time frames of managing patients. And so really good airway management is going to be crucial to, and those basic skills, crucial to managing a patient long term without all of the advanced resources that you're used to having.
Exactly. And listening to you this morning, I realized we could easily do a couple podcasts just on airway complications and patients of disaster. That part really hit me. And yesterday I was having so much fun because I was watching them watching him.
They were engaged,
you.
Right? I mean, they're totally engaged.
They were fascinated. Yeah. And I mean, I've never seen, you know, to get medics to pay attention to anything sometimes, you know, it really has to be, you know, engaging. And you even doing bag valve mask, which is a basic skill, they were totally engaged watching. I mean, it was just fantastic. And the comments I got afterward, there wasn't anybody that wasn't just overwhelmed with new knowledge and they would come back, a lot of them.
Well, that makes us feel great. I mean, and that's why we do it. Like Jim said, we like to, we've been blessed in many ways to have all these different experiences and learn all these lessons, and if we have an opportunity to pass those on to others so they don't have to go through it or go through it the way we had to go through it, then we've given back to a profession that's given us our careers.
Warren, you're recognizing that the newer generation of EMSers, you know, came up with computers and they're kind of over death by PowerPoint. They need the immersion. They need the interactive experience.
And some of that interaction is very simple. And Jamie made a good point, you know, relying on, it's the simple things, really. We had one student yesterday that was, how does this all tie into disaster medicine, right? So this one guy said, was there anything you want to do, else you want to do? He said, you know, I'd really love to do a digital intubation. So that's no tools whatsoever except an endotracheal tube, right? And so I kind of coached him through it, and he said, I've never done one of these. I've always wanted to do one of these. He said, you never know. I see my partner do one, and I got to explain that my only time that I've ever had to do one is because I didn't have at my disposal, because we're in a disaster, right? And you're very limited on your supplies sometimes. And I had a patient in New Orleans at 610 and I-10 during Hurricane Katrina. Came out of the came off the boat, walked up the highway there, which was a makeshift boat ramp for us, and collapsed.
Wow.
Just from dehydration. She had been in her attic for 2 days and collapsed, went into cardiac arrest. And we put her on the hood of a car. There was a medic there, and he said, we need to intubate her. I said, yeah, we need to go ahead and do that. And he handed me a tube. I said, all right, I'm ready for laryngoscopy. He said, I don't know where it is.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's gone. So I had to digitally intubate. So I got to explain that story and my technique and how that all worked. And it's very simple stuff, but you've got to adapt, just like any EMS. You've got to adapt and overcome. But in a disaster situation, more so.
Yeah, it reminds me of Ground Zero. And we'll be talking about a lot of our experiences later, but we were at Ground Zero, you know, in a tent around the pile. And we had this eye doc that walked in and immediately wanted to know where his blue light and his slit lamp were. And I said, you'll want to look around. We're in a tent under an overpass, you know, really? You know, we'll be talking about all of these subjects about how, and that's one of the questions I'll pose, is why is austere? In fact, let's just jump there, because you, in your lecture this morning, wonderful lecture, if you missed it, sorry, the way you described austere medicine really resonated, because I've never been able to really come up with a good, what is it that's different from, you're on the street every day, mm-hmm. medicine. You try to give that, if you can, I mean, it's such a broad term, in a nutshell.
Well, I think it is broad, and you know, Jim certainly pointed out one element of that, which is you have no resources. Your tools are, you know, your hands and your brain and your eyes. I think that's a lot of it. I think the other part of that has to do with sort of time frames in many cases, and the idea that I don't have the opportunity to put the patient in the back of a truck and drive them someplace. I got to take care of them, because this is going to last a long time, and transport may be coming, but it may be tomorrow. And once you sort of get that element of time involved in there, the disease processes are different, the care we provide the patient is different, and the skill set required of the caregiver is very different, because it you don't have those resources. It's not hard to throw guy in backup truck, drive to hospital. Wow. It's very different if hospital is 300 miles away and you got nothing. Now take care of that guy. And to me, that's a true test of what we're here to do, what we learn, how we do it, and why we do it. Because I can do it in that situation. I can do it throwing a guy back a truck anytime, right?
So, well, I mean, I think we're at an EMS conference, but you made a good point about talking about a doctor, a physician coming in and sure. inspecting a certain level of mm-hmm. supplies and care and sure. not having them. It is not just about EMS.
That's
austere
right.
medicine has all levels of health care, public health, primary care, emergency room department, nurses, doctors, everyone in that whole process all have to adapt and overcome, because they don't have the supplies that, you know, let's face it, if a major disaster hits any area, the ER will use up all of their available supplies.
Absolutely.
Very quickly,
sure.
within the first day, maybe 12 hours, and now what do you do?
Mm-hmm.
When those people from the outlying areas start filtering in.
Right.
You know, and,
right.
and so austere medicine, just from the little bit I've been able to glean from hearing you guys talk about it, it's given me a different perspective on it, especially from not just the pre-hospital setting, but the hospital and the public health setting, because there's a lot to say about, I'm going to have this patient that I would normally, you know, if you're EMS, you have a patient for an hour. If you're in an ER, you have a patient for 8 hours. If, you know, no, you're going to have these patients for days.
Right.
And that's kind of, you know, when we get deployed to an area that's been hit, our job as we travel to that site, we're usually the first people there, right, before DMAT gets set up. So we have to take care of things first before DMAT gets there. So we're on the road as a medical specialist team. We're looking at those resources. What hospitals are functional? How long are they functional? How many docs do you have? We even go to the point to where, because we have canines, right?
Right.
We've got to find vets that can take care of our dogs. We find out what reptiles are indigenous to an area, so snakes, bugs, that kind of thing. So we can do safety briefings for our guys. So our first duty is to take care of our team. Second duty is to take care of the victims that found. Sometimes those really get put together. But you do, you're right, Jamie. You got to find out where you can take a member of your team that's ran out of their blood pressure medicine or what, you know.
And there's a lot of that.
Didn't come very prepared. So it's a whole other aspect of medicine. But yeah. The nurses, the docs, the ERs, even the clinics, right, may be your alternative care sites that you have to identify through a community that's been devastated by a hurricane or a tornado. Thank goodness we haven't had an earthquake.
Yes.
That's
not wood, right?
Yes,
yeah, that's your side of the world there. In a while, but those are the things that we've got to be thinking as we're going through. It's sort of like when you make a call in EMS, right? When you get that tone out, you know, and you're in the rig and you're going to the call. Okay, I need to do this, right. And this. As I know
mental
the information, yeah,
sure.
And you get that information back to you. So
I think that's also a lot about taking people out of their silos,
mm-hmm.
and out of their comfort zone, yep. a little bit, and making them do what we're really here to do. But there's not a CT scanner down the hall. You got to figure it out by assessing the patient.
But maybe that's part of the mystique. Maybe that's because I, you know, who are we? Why do we do what we do? And I kind of wanted you two to say, how did you get interested not only in disaster medicine but in USAR? What attracted you to that? What is the kind?
Well, for me, I think it's a lot of what we were just talking about. It's truly an opportunity to depend only on myself. Very limited technology, outside the four walls of where things are all safe. You know, it's very easy for that optometrist to, you know, check out my corneal abrasion if he's got a blue light and this and that and the other. Do it without it.
Yeah.
Then I'm impressed. So, you know, I think it's a lot about using that skill set, using your brain, having to innovate, having to think outside the box, and sort of getting it back to that pure medicine experience of I'm going to have to decide whether or not I think this guy's got appendicitis on the history, physical, and you know, my poking on his belly and saying, you know, something, it's going to take me 6 hours and you know, incredible amounts of resources to fly this guy someplace for somebody to go, oh, he was fine. What? So, you know, just to get a CT scan to find out if the guy's got appendicitis or not. So those are tough decisions. And to me, there's just great personal satisfaction in being able to feel like you can do that and come to a reasonable decision about what you're doing and take good care of the patient and be able to do so and go, no, I didn't need all that other stuff to do that. I was able to do it just with what I got.
Well,
right
and
here.
It's returning to those old-timey right. assessment skills, I want to say, that have an opportunity to really refresh some of the skills maybe you hadn't practiced since medical
sure.
school or
sure.
in your early training. Look, before CT scans, people
that's
identified
right.
appendicitis
exactly
all the time.
Right.
And
right.
were right a good bit of the time
yeah.
because they knew what they were looking for and they had
exactly
the assessment
right.
skills and the history and they could put these things together. We've become spoiled by yes. the electronics and the imaging that we have access to. And good grief, there are numerous studies that come out all the time that say that we over-image our patients all the time
yep.
when we have a 98% success rate doing a physical assessment and getting the diagnosis correct.
Yep.
Yeah, I think it's getting back to the core of why you got in the business
the
that you're in, right? So it's like for me it was the challenge. It's sort of like when you go to EMT school, the challenge of getting your practicals and scoring really well and doing it just perfect. But it's getting back to the basics, and it's sometimes it's a challenge to do that, right? So it's like a I don't know, maybe reinventing yourself in the profession that you're already in.
So has this changed how you do your medicine in the ER, Joe? Are you finding yourself not relying on all of the tools that everybody has available to them because you've learned how to do a good assessment? You're really good at that?
I think I do a better job of selecting the tool. Understanding that there are limitations to the tool, and perhaps not. I rely less on the tool. It still has advantage. It's still necessary in many cases, and it's just nice to sort of go, my percentage of positive CT scans for appendicitis is higher than all the rest of the guys I practice with. Well, that's because I practice making that diagnosis without it a lot, and I've refined that skill, and I think it shows in those kind of numbers.
I think it really refines your critical decision-making skills and your clinical decision-making skills. I mean, it brings you back to things you forgot forever when you're just relying on your what's in your head and what's on your hands.
Why USAR? What attracted you guys to USAR? Was it just opportunity?
And just for the idiot in the bunch.
We had that acronym
thank you,
thing.
Jamie, because we do forget
the acronym podcast.
Yes.
We're going to do an episode where we're going to cover every acronym in the federal dictionary for response.
That's why we have Jamie to remind us of those things that we understand.
USAR and DMAT are two I've heard so far today.
Thank you, Jamie.
I scratch my head and go disaster.
Yes, you're close.
So, tactics.
Disaster Medical Assistance Team, a DMAT, will be doing more podcasts on teams specifically, but it's a federal resource of medical people. So we have EMTs, physicians, PAs, NPs, respiratory, all levels of practitioners, basic, whatever we need as a part of a large contingent. And when we go into a disaster after these guys have done their work, it's to augment a hospital that may have some damage or may not be functional. We can set up a complete, I can't call it a hospital, it's tents. But we have everything to sustain ourselves and to sustain the public. And you were talking earlier about supplies, where hospitals out of supplies. We bring our own. We can sustain ourselves for 72 hours, much like I'm sure the USAR.
So that's managed by the HHS, right?
Yes.
Health and Human Services.
My title is an alphabet. You talk about alphabet soup.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's a whole... It's actually right under the National Disaster Medical System, and then that's a huge array of different.
So I'm not doing the interview, but can I ask a question?
Absolutely.
How many patients, critical patients and non-critical patients, can one DMAT team support for that time frame?
Quite a few. And the interesting thing is Haiti. Right. This was the first international mission we went on. And we have an EPCR type system that sends information up to, we call it the cloud in the sky, which are the federal people looking at what we're doing. And the one thing that really worked was they were able to see the kinds of patients that we were treating and that we needed. Because when they're looking at sending out reinforcements, they want to know who to send. There was a lot of, we have a team called an MSIR, which are surgeons. They sent the surgeons, they sent pediatricians, they were able to send people that they knew. The right people for the job.
So just so you know, that the information system is called JPATS. That's another acronym.
I didn't want to hit him with yet another acronym.
So let's talk about USAR now.
Yes,
what does USAR stand for?
Urban Search and Rescue.
Okay.
So it's under the FEMA umbrella currently. It's bounced kind of through the Department of Homeland Security system for... since its inception, which was back in 1989 during the Loma Prieta earthquakes in San Francisco. So I think President Bush, 41, decided that this was something that we needed. And the program grew, and there are 28 urban search and rescue federal across the United States. Yeah, there are other urban search and rescue teams that are state funded and supported.
Yes.
Then there's the federal. So we should, when we roll in, we're self-sufficient for 72 hours. At least 72 hours.
Right.
But we come with, we travel, by bus, by air. We have tractor trailer rigs full of equipment, and we just roll into a community and go to work and do those search and rescue operations and medical missions, much like we did at Katrina and some others in terms of
teams. So you have the heavy search and rescue. You have dog teams that can help search for people. So your job is to find the people, and then when we get there, we're a resource to help take take care of that. But you do that as well. So
we
as,
do.
A, as a USAR doc, what exactly do you do, Joe?
Well, the medical component of the USAR team is, as Jim sort of talked about earlier, that, you know, one of our first responsibilities is taking care of the team. Clearly, crawling under buildings that are falling down is dangerous work.
Yeah.
So, you know, the possibility of significant injury to one of our team members is significant. That incorporates also a bit of a veterinary component because the dog is a vital member of the team, and we don't operate without the dog, so we take care of dogs. And then ultimately take care of the patient that we're there to take care of in the first place. You know, we have the capability of taking care of probably 25 critically injured or sick patients for some period of time. We're not going to be a long-term solution, obviously. A lot of our goal is we've got those processes started. Now we need to get that patient moving to more definitive care down the line someplace. But, you know, I think part of the thing that's different between the USAR environment and the DMAT environment is, you know, USAR is literally out in the neighborhood searching, and DMAT has become the resource that has replaced the local resource that's gone. The hospital is destroyed. DMAT's literally in the parking lot, being the ER, and being the hospital that's not there anymore. So there's an interaction between federal USAR teams and federal DMAT teams as great drop-off points for patients that we come across. We know where you guys are. You're part of our information system, and so, you know, we know you're in the parking lot over there, and we know what you can do. So we're going to try to get those patients back to.
So to put it in perspective, we're the pre-hospital component, and they are the hospital component.
There you go. Yeah.
And I think, you know, so one of the things that I think Paragon brings to the table when you guys go in and do education on something like this is you really bring those skills that you've picked up, whether it's through your USAR training or what people are going to be expecting to do, because before USAR gets there, the responders on the ground are going to be there.
Right.
And that's where that training component comes in and becomes
exactly
so important,
right,
because they need to have some of these skills, these austere medical skills in hand before the disaster happens. Because like you said, it's going to be a once in a lifetime occurrence, and you want to be able to do it and not train for it after the fact.
Right. Exactly right.
Yeah, you want to be prepared when you walk in. Because the goal of disaster response in general is to get that area and those people back to where they were as much as we can, you know, before we leave.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not going to go in there and reinvent their system, but at least try to get them back to where they were, where their resources
were. Some level of self-sufficiency again.
Exactly. And some are harder than others. And Katrina was a good example of that because it was so widespread and it took out so many of their resources. I mean, they're still recovering as far as I know.
Absolutely.
And I think that's an important point, is that you're never going to make it all 100% better every time. I mean, you can have a goal to make it back to the point of self-sufficiency, but at some point the local system needs to take over again, and that's your goal, is to get them to that point.
Well, I think, you know, there's another little bit of a perspective to that a lot of what these kind of teams supply to an impacted area is a structure. That's a communication structure, a way to work structure that has been destroyed. And so they rely on a team coming in to provide that structure until they can rebuild their own structure, which allows them to move from, our fire department's been devastated because all of my guys, you know, all the buildings are down and my guys are all gone. We got no communication to, while we tagged up with you guys and we could communicate to you guys. And now those guys, instead of being victims, are paired with the USAR team going, that's the street we want to go down. There's so-and-so right down there. And those guys are back at work.
And that happens. It's not like we just come in and, like you see on TV, with the feds come in and say, well, we're here, you step back. It's not like that at all. We get with the local responders, and exactly like Dr. Holly said, is, you know, what are your effect? We need them. We need each other, right? And what are your effective areas? We're here to help what you're doing. This is your community. This is your neighborhood. We're here to help, because these guys, once we get there, because it takes us a little bit to get there. We have to roll out the door within, we try to get out within between 4 and 6 hours. And then we got travel time. So by the time we get there, they might have lost crews due to family circumstances, equipment circumstances. So they welcome us with open arms, and we work in conjunction with them very, very well.
And I tell you, one of the deployments I went on, it was the coolest thing ever. cover, because walking in, they had one particular area. I wouldn't really call it a triage, but it was kind of an incoming area for people. And to see those ER folks working alongside those medical folks with our federal uniform on, and they were just like this. It was like they'd been there forever. And to see that kind of interaction, that's really what this is about. It's like, we're not walking in and pushing them away. We are becoming part of their organization and right. helping them with what they do. We're augmenting their services.
And that's what Paragon tries to do. We're really big on integration. I mean, we have lived in silos for so long with law enforcement, EMS, fire, and we say we work together, and we do for the most part, but there is some integration work to be done. And with our courses, we invite all comers. We have models to where we have nurses suit up in fire gear just to see what it feels exactly. like, and go in those high stress environments with fake smoke and fire and secondary devices going off, just so we can work better together. I think we have a better understanding of what each other does when we do that.
You've then worked a lot of side. International folks, I noticed.
Yeah, we had we had some people from Ireland. We had a whole
South Korean.
South Korean. They probably
Koreans.
Don't have this kind
awesome.
Of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. What else? Australia, Canada, Mexico. It was.
That's
well,
excellent. Cool.
Excellent. I think I'm from Alaska.
Alaska. Well, that's a lot. But that's United States.
You know, that's yeah.
We'll wrap up this first segment here. On that note, which is that we have opportunities to work together to integrate with federal, state, and local resources as they become available to rebuild the structure. And training is an important part of that. So I want to thank you guys for being on this episode again. And again, thank you for your support to create this podcast, because it's really important that we get the word out and notify and alert people to opportunities to train better and be prepared in a more efficient way for their emergencies and disasters. Sam?
Our last word on this is not your everyday medicine. And in the podcast to come, we're going to convince you of that.